Say, are you guys going to Davenport? My car died and I'm late for a luncheon.
We usually don't pick up hitchhikers. But I'm gonna go with my instinct on this one. Saddle up, partner. You're it. Quitsies!
Any quitsies?
You're it, quitsies. No, any quitsies, no starsies.
You can't do that.
Can't do?
Cannot. Stamped it.
Can't do double stamped it, no erases.
Cannot. Triple stamped it, no erases. Touch
no,
blue,
no,
make it
no,
through.
No. You can't triple stamp a double stamp. You can't triple stamp a double stamp, Lloyd. You can't triple stamp a double stamp. Lloyd! You
guys! Enough!
Hey, want to hear the most annoying sound in the world?
Guys!
Recorded live in the USA and covering the whole wide world, this is the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Right on!
With Bob Seska and Chez Pazienza.
Here's how great it is to be white. I could get in a time machine and go to any time, and it would be fucking awesome when I get there. That is exclusively a white privilege. Black people can't fuck with time machines. A black guy in a time machine is like, hey, anything before 1980, no thank you, I don't want to go. But I can go to any time. The year 2? I don't even know what was happening then. But I know when I get there, welcome, we have a table right here for you, sir. Thank you. Lovely here in the year, too.
The following podcast contains harsh language, nudity, graphic violence, adult situations, and a healthy obsession with empirical reality. The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
No, I was just going to say that. The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Yep.
I'm Bob Seska here. That's Chez Pazienza right over there.
It is.
Oh, my God. You know, it's one of those days where I thought it was going to go one way, and it ended up going a completely different way. I got a lot of...
How's that?
Well, I got a lot of funny responses to my Huffington Post piece yesterday about government workers. You know, it's not an easy task defending bureaucrats, but leave it to me, and I'll do it. Well, I mean, really, let's be honest here. I mean, you know, they're actual people who have actual lives, actual mortgages, families. You know, they're trying to save for college. They're trying to make car payments and trying not to, you know, end up unemployed like all the rest of us. And they're real jobs. Trust me. You go to a job and you're working for the government, whether it's the state government, local government, federal government. It's a job. You know, you get paid to be there 40 hours a week. You get weekends.
Sure.
Time off, health care, hopefully. But they have really, you know, solid benefits, things that kind of don't exist anymore in the private sector. You know, you can get time off for vacation. You can have health insurance. And
well, it's always ugly whenever we broad stroke, whenever we, you know, and I'm guilty of it, too. Whenever we look at government and say government is this big entity and there's, you know, there aren't actual people running it. And it's the same way with, you know, I mean, we come down very hard on Wall Street, and a lot of times those titans of Wall Street very much deserve it. But there are people who work in the trenches there who just bust their asses, and, you know, they're not guilty of burning down the freaking global economy.
That's right.
So,
well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people think that, you know, every federal employee or state employee, for that matter, is just some pinheaded bureaucrat who, you know, gives them a hard time on the telephone when they call the 800 number. It's not that way. I mean, there are a lot of people doing a lot of good things in government. I mean, that's what government's all about. It's, you know, part of the bureaucracy is you know, sort of the original idea of the founding of this country. It's, you know, it's we the people. The people control the government, whether it's a representative elected government or whether it's people actually doing the day-to-day business of government.
That's interesting, actually, because the right seems to hold the founding fathers up as these quasi-religious deities, these gods who came down from Mount Olympus to let us all know the proper way to govern ourselves. Yeah. And yet the government that they set up is constantly pilloried by the right.
Yeah.
You know, they're constantly beating up on it. And basically, you know, these people who created this this fantastic country for us and this fantastic sort of system of government. And yet there are people on the right who, while hailing them, also basically look at government and say, oh, yeah, well, it sucks. And never mind that they set it up. They didn't really want it. And it was like it was some kind of bad joke.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of cherry picking going on of what the founding fathers intended. And a lot of it's misunderstood. I mean, every time, you know, you really got to get suspicious when you start seeing
they apparently spent a lot of time trying to stop slavery.
That's right. Invariably, and that's exactly where I was going with this, is that, you know, they end up misquoting or misinterpreting history. That happens, sure. You know, quite a bit. I mean, a lot of people like to say, well, you know, a lot of conservatives like to say, I'm a Thomas Jefferson Republican. Well, that doesn't make any sense. You can't be a Thomas Jefferson Republican. It's nearly impossible. I mean, let's face it. I mean, things change. Ideologies change. Party affiliations change. Things are very different now than they were as far as, alignment of policy and ideas than they were, 250 years ago. And that's just a fact. So you can't say that, Thomas Jefferson blanket in an across the board way agrees with everything you say and vice versa. It just doesn't work that way. You know, you can kind of look and see, which guy had certain ideas that line with yours and make an argument to justify something you say based on that. But you can't say that all of the founding fathers, as if they were had one unifying idea or set of ideas, were right. Exactly like you. I mean, it's just
the right pitch is that they were not flawed men.
Yeah. That's right.
That, like I said, they're sort of these deities, and the Constitution is basically the American Bible. Mm-hmm. The fact that there are people on the right, the people on the right tend to be very religious, and the way they treat the Constitution and the way they treat the founding fathers is it's religious. It's a religion. It's astonishing to watch. These people are infallible. They apparently had foresight that none of their contemporaries had. It really is like the way the right also looks at the Bible.
Yeah. Well, I think the larger point, and, it's kind of a rabbit hole to dive into when you start getting into and interpreting what the founding fathers meant, because there's a lot of different writings. And as I said, each founding father had different ideas that you could kind of pick and choose each idea to apply to different ideologies of modern times. And so it's a little bit of a risky proposition. So a lot of things that you say about founding fathers tend to be kind of general. And what we do know in a general sense is that the founding fathers wanted a government of the people. I think that's fair to say. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that. I don't think there's a whole lot to disprove that. But regardless, I think there's the more specific issues that we have here with regards to government workers is that the conservative Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans, want to tell us that government workers are not real workers and they don't work in real jobs because, after all, government doesn't create jobs. What do you call all those people who go to a job? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's confusing. It's one of those things where you feel like after a few minutes of it, you want to beat your face against the brick wall. Because
that's
productive.
Almost everything these days for me.
Yeah. And it's just
anything
more...
at all. Bring up any subject. Yeah. Go ahead.
And so I guess what I'm getting at here ultimately is, and you can go read the Huffington Post. I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on that because I had everything that I wanted to say there in print. But, I think, what was more important is that, it kind of started off the day going in one direction where I thought, okay, yeah, I'm going to be focusing on this and I'm going to be looking up I'm going to be reading the Federalist Papers today and going back through and finding different motivations for the founding fathers, looking up employment statistics and things like that and responding to all of these responses. So I was going to get them back and forth. And, and the one thing that I wasn't going to respond to, of course, was on Twitter. Guess who tried to stir something up again? And who tried to bait me into giving him some attention?
Oh, forget it. All right, I know.
Lee Stranahan.
Of course.
and that, that actually, I believe, started a kind of an avalanche of email responses because I think I got more
what
negative.
What was his issue? I guess I could go look for myself.
It was the founding fathers thing, and... completely ignore, you know, the rest of the 95% of the piece that I wrote. You're going to go right to the last paragraph and say, well, what? This isn't right.
How could his fingers reach the computer keyboard since I assume they're wrapped around Breitbart's cock?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I do what I can.
But yeah, so, you know, it's always so tempting, and he knows exactly how to push those buttons, man. You know, he did it the other day where he called out Sam Cedar, and then Sam Cedar had him on the show, on Sam Cedar's show, and the Majority Report.
Because he just says something? Who gives a shit?
Yeah, Stranahan said something on Twitter, and then Sam Cedar had Stranahan on his show for a half an hour. But you know what? It was actually kind of worth it. And it was a little bit of schadenfreude on my part to know that someone else was going to try to wrap their brain around, you know, Lee's trollmongering.
Right.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, Lee says one thing about government spending and, you know, and then, you know, of course, Sam Cedar's a smart guy. Sam Cedar just ran circles around him. But, you know, it's sort of a futile exercise because Stranahan doesn't care about the finer points of policy and numbers. He's not in it for that. He's in it for, you know, I'm going to say something and I'm going to get a bunch of attention for it. And I'll kind of be insufferable and nice guy in my response to it, but I got what I want. So, you know, why not?
The thing that bugs me, and by the way, you know, so far all the conversations I've ever had, I joke about him, but all the conversations I've ever had with Stranahan, he's been nothing but nice to me, and yeah. He seems like an okay guy to me. I add that disclaimer. Like I said, it's easy to joke about the fact that he's sort of in with Breitbart, but one of the things that I do notice that he does
after the cock remark, right?
Well, that's like I said. What do you want from me? I'm just a foul-mouthed
asshole.
He's
a nice guy.
Right. I mean, yeah, he's stroking Breitbart's cock, but he's a nice guy. He's doing it well. It's important to have a job that makes a difference.
Yeah.
As they said on Clark. So, no, I mean, my point was that one of the things, his sort of way of doing things actually kind of scares me a little bit because you see a lot of this on the internet with the rise of social media, and it becomes very, very hard to sort of tell fact from fiction, which is that he really pummels you with lots of quote unquote facts.
Yeah.
While, I mean, some of which I've actually seen like major, major holes in some of the things that he says, but he sounds very legit. I mean, he does. You know, it sounds like everything that's coming out of his mouth or off his computer keyboard, you know, it all sounds very legit because it's like, you know, he throws a hell of a lot of statistics and a hell of a lot of facts out there. But the fact is that they're probably not all of them are correct.
Yeah.
And I guess that one of the things that bothers me about that sort of way of doing things, and I mean, guys like Glenn Greenwald do it too, and I'm sure we're going to get to that in a little
bit. Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
I know. But I mean, guys, you know, people on both sides tend to do that. And yet you look at it and it's still, it just doesn't make, I don't know.
It doesn't, well, it doesn't have to make sense. All it has to do is be superficially.
My brain is really fried this week, by the way. My mom got, I throw this out there. My mom got diagnosed with cancer like 2 weeks ago. So I've you know, in and out of a cancer hospital and my brain is absolute mush this week. So I apologize in advance. If you're like carrying me off the battlefield later, I'm sorry.
Well, God, I'm sorry to hear about that. That's terrible.
That is. She'll be all right, though, probably. Mastectomy on Monday, so we'll see.
Oh, my God, yeah. And you know what? They just they just discovered this this virus that evidently cures all
I
forms
heard
of
that. Yeah. I mean, I didn't bring it up last week. I didn't want to bring up my, you know, some of that personal stuff because it's just, you know, it's weird. I'm happy to talk about like how shitty my marriages were, but when it comes to talking about, you know, my mom's cancer for some reason, I don't, you know, I feel like I'm treading on, you know, on somebody else's personal matters or whatever. But either way, yeah, she'll probably be fine. Obviously, like I said, I've been in and out of the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa for the past like week. So anyway, enough about that. We should move on. Seriously.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but if I start like mumbling because I haven't gotten a lot of sleep, that's the reason why.
There you go. Well, you know, I think. Well, first of all, Godspeed to your mother. I hope she's fine and I hope she's okay.
Thank you.
Hope everything works out.
I appreciate
that. But getting back to Stranahan. Right. No, I'm kidding. Just wrapping that up. You know, I mean, you can't make heads or tails. But what Sam Seder finally deduced was that Lee makes things, he says things, blurts things out based on his gut. So in a certain way, there's kind of a weird logic to what he has to say. But then once you delve below the surface, there ain't nothing there. And that's as soon as Sam Seder started talking about the numbers.
Though. But that's what I was kind of trying to make the point about and doing it really horribly, is that he goes with his gut, but at the same time, he offers all of these, you know, he goes sort of like scrounging for these facts that back him up. And it all sounds very, very ironclad, but it's not. It never is. When I speak from my gut, I'm more than happy. You know, I get this all the time. If you read my stuff on my blog, 9 times out of 10, I mean, I'm happy to put some facts in there, but a lot of times it's just my opinion. And yeah. I'm more than willing to say that. Look, you know what? These are overall views that I'm expressing. They are based, obviously, on facts, on evidence. But I don't throw out a bunch of statistics at people and say, here, see, this proves my point. It's like, look, you know what? It's almost like, you know, you read me because either you agree with me or you don't agree with me, and I hope that I entertain you a little bit. And I get my point across because I feel like, you know, I write. I'm one of those people who writes because I feel like I have to. I've never been sort of the statistical writer. I've never been somebody who just throws out all of these supposed, all this just bastion of freaking, you know, fusillade of facts, of supposed facts that I throw out there. So, I don't know. Once again, I've reached a dead end. Seriously, my mind is not working.
Well, yeah, but no, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying. But the difference between you and someone like Lee is that when you are presented with a series of facts that may not exactly coincide with what you just said, you're not so dishonest that you go, screw you, or you try to skew the conversation away and you're doing some sort of weird end around where it perpetuates the argument, but you know full well and you've just been brutally proven wrong. You don't do that. You don't do that.
I'm always happy to admit when I'm wrong. Always happy to admit when I'm wrong. And I'm also happy to admit, like I said, since I tend to speak in sort of large themes to me, I find that a lot of the things that people argue with me about on the blog, they, honest to God, are, look, you're just approaching this from a different point of view than I am. We have the same facts. You're just approaching it from, you feel that this is okay, I don't, or I feel that this is okay and you don't. And that's okay. And I think that's one of the reasons why when I really get into it with people after a while and it turns into, like, this happens on Facebook all the time. It turns into, like, these back and forth with, you know, somebody throwing out a bunch of statistics for me and then, you know, I'm compelled to throw out some statistics for them. And then it just turns into, well, look, you know what? We all have basically the same information. We're just approaching it from completely different ways. And because of that, there is zero reason for you and I to continue this back and forth because it's trying to teach a pig to sing and it wastes your time and annoys the pig.
But at some point,
it's not going to get us anywhere. Let's just, you know, agree, as they say, agree to disagree and be freaking done with it.
Yeah. But I mean, at some point you have to arrive upon some kind of objective centerpiece of the
but
discussion.
But that's what we talked about last week. The problem these days is that there is so much media out there. And like I was kind of like, once again, the shitty point I was making, Lee presents so much of his stuff and he's not the only one. I'm not, you know, beating up on him, but people tend to present so much. There are so many outlets these days for people to present their stuff as fact that there is no, we talked about it last week. I think I called it like there's no Johnny Carson for news. Mm-hmm. There's no one sort of touchstone, one well where everybody draws their information from anymore. I mean, now you don't just approach it with different opinions. People can approach it with different sets of facts and some can be bullshit. And the question I think very roundabout that I was trying to get to originally is when Lee writes this, especially, and I know some of his stuff is not quite on the up and up, and not to knock him. He may just, you know, I'm sure I doubt there's like sort of an intentional desire to fool you in there somewhere. But how do you know? How do you know what is, with all the different media outlets out there and all this information coming your way, how can you tell anymore what's fact and what's crap?
Well, there are sources, I think, for as close to empirical fact as we can possibly get. I mean, that's it. We have to kind of decide upon where to go for numbers and who to rely upon for these things. You know, I think, and this is the last thing I have to say about Stranahan, because here I started the conversation by saying, yeah, Lee's a troll. And now I'm going to spend 10 minutes talking about the troll. Right. But, you know, what he will often do is say something that, again, on the surface sounds real. The reason he and I had a falling out a couple of years ago and stopped doing a show together was because I could no longer deal with what happened below that surface layer. So, for example, he would say Max Baucus is obstructing healthcare and President Obama is working with Max Baucus, therefore President Obama hates healthcare reform. And that was his position. And then I would say, well, Max Baucus is in charge of the Finance Committee. He's the chairman of the Finance Committee, in fact. And the whole bill has to go through the Finance Committee because there are big chunks of it that have to do with Social Security and Medicare. And the Finance Committee is tasked with anything that has to do with those two things, Social Security and Medicare. So therefore, Max Baucus has to be part of the process. You can't have health care reform unless Max Baucus, that one guy, is somehow involved in the negotiations and is, in fact, a major player in it. Okay, so I would describe that, and Lee would go, well, Obama's still working with Max Baucus. So Obama hates health care. And I go, what? I just explained to you that he's got to. And it was, again, going back to what I was originally saying.
If it sinks, it's a witch.
That's right. It's
or
like
if it floats, it's a witch.
Yeah. Or it's like Wayne. I posted this about this earlier, that like Wayne LaPierre, the executive director of the NRA, said this week that all of the president's favorable pro-gun things indicate that he's coming for your guns. How do you refute that? Well, you don't. You just stop, call attention to it, because it is absurd, and we do have to call attention to absurdity sometimes, and then just move on, because there's no discussing it. There's nothing below that.
It's a leap of logic based on you're basically filling in the blanks with frog DNA. You're filling in the blanks with whatever your personal beliefs are. You know, this is if this happens and this happens, then that it definitely means this. Well, it doesn't really. It could mean that or a million other things. Oh, but it definitely means this because I believe it means this. Okay, fuckwit. That'll work.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think ultimately what I'm trying to get at, and by the way, you win the internet for the frog DNA thing. The Jurassic Park reference. But, you know, I think ultimately, and this is going back to what I was saying at the top of the show, I thought the whole day was going to be around that, but it turned out that the whole day ended up being about this column that Melissa Harris Perry wrote.
And you went crazy. I've never seen you write anything that long that wasn't a Huffington.
No.
I kept reading that, and I'm just like, when the fuck does this thing end?
Right. And that was in addition to the Huffington Post column I posted. So, like, today's contribution to the blog, two things, and they're both, like, 5,000 words long.
I'm glad you made up for my week, which has basically just been a bunch of, like, you know, Seattle sound listening posts and quotes, because I've been so busy.
Yeah. It's funny. Joy's homesick today, and I hit post on that post about the Melissa Harris Perry thing and got up and went over to get a drink of water, and I said, yeah, I just had some verbal diarrhea there. And that's exactly what it was. I just started typing. And it, like Throw Mama from the Train, all I did was type, and I just had this ended up with this very long post. But it's something that I write about a lot, and it's something that is discussed a lot. And in fact, I think it's quite important. And just giving some background to those of you who haven't heard it yet or read it yet, Melissa Harris Perry wrote a piece, an extraordinary column for The Nation, in which she said that she basically outlined the possibility for progressive discontentment with the president being about racism, or it's about race, that there's the possibility of white liberal racism and how that's contributing to an anti-Obama sentiment on the left. And I think that's accurate. And I think rather than discuss the actual racism of it, because I think Melissa Harris Perry does a fantastic job of outlining how and why that could possibly be. There are some other things that I wanted to discuss that actually contribute to that point, because I don't know that it's just about racism. I think it's racism. I think plus what else did I say? It's racism plus careerism.
Racism, careerism, and delusion.
And delusion.
Said.
That's right. And I think it's legitimately those things. I think each one, and I don't know that each individual figurehead in the progressive movement has all of those traits. Maybe one of them. Hey, maybe none of them. Maybe they're just, I don't know. Maybe they're just full of shit. Who knows?
Right.
But the Melissa Harris Perry piece really, really speaks for itself. And she...
It's very good.
Yeah. Well, what she did was she kind of said, well, here was the support for President Clinton during his reelection campaign, and it was pretty overwhelming, even though his record wasn't as strong as President Obama's record going into his reelection campaign. So you had very strong support for Clinton from the left in 1996. You have much weaker support for President Obama, even though President Obama's record is, in a variety of different ways, liberal policy being one of them, a lot better. Okay, so therefore, what is the missing piece to this puzzle? What does that call attention to? There's some X factor here that doesn't make any sense. How could there be all this support for that guy, dwindling support for this guy? And her conclusion was, well, if we see results turn out this way in 2012, if President Obama has dwindling support, and he already does. I mean, white support for the president dropped from, I think, 69% to 33%. I mean, it's staggering to see all of that, to see a decline like that.
Right.
And if we see that play out in the election, then the conclusion that we can draw is that it's racially motivated, because there's... What are the differences? Let's look at the differences between these two presidents.
Well, once, you know, we just, before, you know, shoot holes and or acknowledge anyone who's listening to this who will notice sort of the irony of the comment that I just made and what you just said, which is she presents a very good argument, but it's not necessarily, you know, it's a hell of a jump to say that because there's dwindling support for Obama from white progressives, that it has to be or is very likely about race. Now, I agree that there's definitely, you know, it's something worth looking into. There's no doubt about it. But to be 100% sure of that, or to say, well, look, you know, look, it has to be that. That's basically making anybody, including, you know, me, because I've done it too, guilty of the same things that I was just criticizing people for 2 seconds ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a hard time making the racism argument, though.
Whenever somebody says, well, you know, you're playing the race card or whatever, I'm like, you have no idea what it took for me to finally play the race card. It took me forever to admit that there was any, because the last thing you want to do is bring up racism, because when you do, that opens an entirely new can of worms, and it takes the argument to a whole new level.
Well, there's obvious racism, which we see a lot of on the right, especially from Rush Limbaugh and some of the more southern politicians in Congress.
Right.
But, you know, it's a little more difficult to see on the left. And so, therefore, I don't often engage in that argument, because it's much more vague. And in fact, it's something that I think you almost have to be black in order to see it, because I think racism is only visible to white people to a certain extent. And we can only relate to it in a kind of a textbook way. So it's a little more difficult for us to pick it out, because we're not feeling it firsthand. It's not happening necessarily to us. We can see it and identify it if it's obvious, and we can call it out. But it's a little more difficult to kind of parse, you know, when it happens in a more vague sense. So therefore, that's what I'm saying. If you want to hear and read about Melissa Harris Perry's, you know, analysis of this, read the piece in The Nation. I link to it on the blog. And then also make sure to read her response to some of her critics about that column, which is almost a better piece. I mean,
she kicked the crap out of Joan Walsh.
Yeah,
no,
I mean,
Joan Walsh is not my friend. You are not my friend, white woman.
Yeah, I mean, that was remarkable. I mean, then I go back and see, that's exactly what I'm saying. When I read Joan Walsh's response, and she's talking about, well, Melissa Harris Perry is my friend, and she's my friend. Oh, and by the way, Melissa Harris Perry is my friend. We've known each other for a long time. Oh, and did I mention she's my friend? I'm reading that, and I'm going, okay, yeah, this is getting exhausting, but I didn't see the, you know, for lack of a better term, I didn't see the racial component of that. And then I read Melissa Harris Perry's response, where she said, you know, it's the basically the equivalent of saying, I'm not racist. Look, here's my black friend.
But that's, you know what, here's the issue that I have with that. And I like Melissa Harris Perry a lot, and I certainly respect her. It's a very strange dichotomy, because on the one hand, I get that I'm a white guy, so therefore I don't understand. I don't pretend to understand. But I'm always a little bit nervous about the idea of being accused of racism and constantly be with no way to defend against it. How do you refute it? How do you defend against it when you know in your heart what you mean, what you're trying to say, and someone else who is black, or maybe not even black, somebody who's Hispanic or somebody who's another nationality, can take it the wrong way or can assume, you know, one of the worst, man, one of the, you know, worst things you will go through if you are, I know, put upon white guy, is basically though being accused of being, or of saying something racist. And the idea is, well, you don't even know you're being racist. It's like, well, wait a minute. If my intentions are not to be racist at all, if my intentions are pure, then why am I getting shit for this?
Well, sometimes it's baked into the environmental pie. I mean, we could say something racist.
No, and
we
get don't, that. I do.
Yeah. I mean, we could have zero intention of actually being making a racially motivated or racially biased remark. That, I mean, we get just zero intention of that. But because of all kinds of factors, environmental, societal, there sometimes we'll say something that is just that ends up sounding racism and racist. And you could just absolutely not have any, again, zero motivation. You just have no
right.
reason
but
to
I'm,
be racist.
But I'm one of those people, though, who believes in intent versus impact. What is the intent of a comment? You know, impact is one thing. You know, and granted, if you wander around like an ignorant asshole constantly making comments that upset people, even if you don't know you're doing it, eventually you've got to sort of learn your lesson a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I can't believe that even if she was doing it subconsciously, and once again, how do you defend against that? How do you refute something like that while you're doing it subconsciously? Even if she was doing it subconsciously, I don't believe that Joan Walsh was specifically saying something that was racist to her. I really don't. And I think that Melissa Harris Perry, although, like I said, it was fun to read, I actually think she really kind of kicked Joan Walsh way too hard on that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it was a valid point. I think Melissa Harris Perry made a valid point about that, because in a lot
again,
of ways,
how do you defend?
Yeah, but
how
but
do you?
You don't.
I mean, yeah,
you
sure.
Don't.
The old line about some of my best friends are black. I mean, yeah, we all know that's bullshit. But if you have lots of black friends or quite a few black friends and you speak to them one on one about race and you try desperately to understand what it is that they're going through, even though you will never understand it fully, never. And you know that. Doesn't that make it about as good as you can do as, quite frankly, somebody who's not persecuted, but somebody who wants to understand what it's like?
Well,
you know, and I got to believe that Joan Walsh actually, you know, she's about as sort of open-hearted liberal as you can get.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think Melissa Harris Perry's response was Joan Walsh is a racist. I think Melissa Harris Perry's response was more to the effect of, you know, this is not a valid counterargument. And this is the kind of counterargument that we need to stop doing. This we can't counter accusations of racism by saying, well, this black person is my friend, so how can I be racist? So it was just like it was not necessarily impugning Joan Walsh as much as it was, you know, this is no kind of response. I expected more. And so therefore, let's get back
but once
to
again, what kind of response would be the proper response? How do you defend? That's what I'm getting at. It would seem, once again, I think Melissa Harris Perry is a very incredibly bright woman. You know, I should not even be uttering her name. She's so freaking much smarter than me, believe me. But what would have been the proper response? Would the only thing that would have made her, I don't want to say happy, but the only thing that would have sort of satisfied her would be to say, you know what, you're right. I don't understand. I'll never understand. I'm just going to sit this one out and allow you to flay me.
No, no, no. You don't sit it out. But you certainly don't start your argument about racism with, here's my black friend. You know what I mean? It's just, it was
a, I do that it all the time. As a matter of fact, I actually walk around with a black person.
It's like that great
no matter where I am.
That Stephen Colbert photo that he wheels out occasionally.
Yep.
Where he's sitting there, he's got this big
in
goofy ear to ear grin.
I have a guy who, yeah, I call him my black friend.
Your black friend.
He wears a t-shirt and everything so that I can deflect accusations of racism. So whenever, you know, whenever I make a joke about how hard it is for black people to get cabs after midnight in Manhattan, yeah. You know, I no, see, not racist. Here, Kelsey, step up. Say hi.
Right, right. Well, see, I think it was more of a cautionary tale to say, well, look, you can be racist without intending to be racist because, you know what, like it or not, and for better or worse, this is how it's perceived. And I think, I hate to put it this way, but I think part of the white penance for centuries of oppression of minorities is that, you know what, until these societal factors disappear, we kind of got to be careful. You know, we can't just go around and cavalierly throw around things like, yeah, I'm not racist, look at my black friends. Because this is how these things get started, and this is how those societal aspects of racism get perpetuated by continuing to, you know, feed that beast. And right. I think the interesting thing is that the
blowback that you get from that kind of thing, though, is that it turns into a form of sort of stifling political correctness. And my God, I would never in a million years say that it's the same kind of oppression that black people went through or in some cases are still going through. Of course not. It's not that at all. But political correctness and saying you can't say this or you're being racist or you're being offensive. Offensive is even a better word because it's even more vague. You're being offensive and you don't even know it. That after a while, that makes people just say, you know what? Fuck you. I'm going to be as offensive as I possibly can. And I mean, I think that that's one of the reasons why you played Louis C.K. there at the beginning. I think one of the things that makes Louis so absolutely brilliant is that he fights back against the sort of oppression of I can't say that or you can't say that. And he doesn't worry one bit about whether it comes off as racist. Or anti-gay or anything like that, and that's what I really appreciate about it. Yeah.
Well, comedians are different. I think comedians are at least a comedian like Louis C.K. or before him George Carlin, Bill Hicks. You know,
the canary in the coal mine when it comes to like you know what you can get away with.
Right, the really great satirical comics are always making a remark about it. I even think Howard Stern is like this too, where I think a lot of what on the outside and on a very superficial level appears to be racism is actually not. It's comments upon racism and pointing out the absurdity of it and saying this is how
racism, pointing out the absurdity of it. And also there's something and I do this. I make these kinds of jokes all the time. There's something very self-deprecating about it that when you say stuff like that, it's almost like you're saying, oh, look what a douche I am. You know, it's you know, that's part of the joke.
Yeah. Well, we're going to run long today. I just know it.
Okay.
Because we haven't really even gotten into it yet. But we got to take a break here for some Bubble Genius here. Pure product, pure genius, Bubble Genius. This show.
I got their soap. I got the big basket of soap.
You did, finally. I guess you superseded my authority of presenting the address and actually sent them your address.
They kept bothering me for it. It's really good. It is. It's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, it smells great. And my God, the different shapes and varieties of soaps that they actually can create is hands down easily the largest selection of soaps that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And because they're created by liberal people and independent business people, I think it makes it even better. So here's the latest commercial from Bubble Genius.
Well, it looks like summer skedaddled and that wicked winter air is setting in.
And you know how washing up in winter can leave your hands drier than Rick Perry's hooses on a Saturday night.
Well, friend, fret no more. Whip your dry skin into shape
with whoop-ass hand balm from Bubble Genius.
Them good folks over at Bubble Genius have looted up their whoop-ass with a whole mess of nature's goodies,
like genuine shea butter and sweet almond oil,
citrus extracts, and sage,
which are wonderful for healing and fixing your skin right up.
This here ain't no sissy hand balm. This here's some serious stuff.
So if long days out on the range are leaving your skin tighter than socks on a rooster,
then it sure is time to open a can of whoop-ass.
By the by, this stuff's great on rough elbows.
And knees, too. Hear that, Mitch McConnell?
Check out the entire line of whoop-ass products, including body whip and soap, at BubbleGenius.com.
Bubble Genius. Y'all suds up now, you hear?
Shove Bob and Chez into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go. Subscribe to the Bob and Chez Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
In your pants. Make sure to enter your promo code Bob and Chez, BobAndChez, and get 15% off your entire order from Bubble Genius. And so we're going to continue with this this conversation about the Melissa Harris Perry column. I think it's extraordinarily important, and mainly because I think the Obama reelection chances hinge upon the left getting behind his candidacy, behind his reelection. And I am genuinely concerned.
And they are not.
Yeah. And they are certainly not behind him
at all.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, a lot of them will say, ah, look, I'm just one guy. I'm just one writer. And what impact do I really have? But it's big. I mean, you sort of create enough of a groundswell and you know, anger, for better or worse, at least on the internet, is contagious. I mean, this stuff spreads. I mean, you start a meme on the internet, and if it resonates, if it gets some attention, even if it's just idle inchoate shouting, it actually begins to, you know, sort of go viral, and then one thing leads to another, and suddenly we've got, you know, President Rick Perry.
But it's exactly what you said. I mean, it's one person starts writing this stuff, and I think part of the reason it's the careerism thing you talked about.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why so many people have decided that they're going to write about this is because it's page hits. It brings in an audience. I've actually taken now, you know, my favorite is Greenwald. I pick on him constantly. I mean, I'm sure he gives a rat's ass what I think, but it's gotten to the point now where whenever he puts up something on Twitter or something like that, I read over it. I immediately know what it's about. It takes 2 seconds. He's going to blame the U.S. for something. He's going to blame Obama for something. It's all our fault. It's, you know, he's the last man standing when it comes to journalistic integrity. And I never bother clicking the link anymore. I just don't care.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm feeding a troll.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, whether we like it or not, these guys are extraordinarily influential. It's just it begins to infect the discourse and things become skewed. And you say, well, you just take people who purport themselves as being serious writers are taken seriously by the people who read them, unless it's with a critical eye. And I think I think a lot of people take David Sirota seriously. I mean, he writes for
David Sirota under no circumstances should ever be taken seriously on anything.
Definitely
ever.
Not. Well, I mean, here's
all you have to do is remind people one more time that he wrote what I have to assume, because I checked it over a bunch of times. I'm like, it seems anyway like he's serious. He wrote a book blaming the current political situation in the United States on Ghostbusters.
That's right.
That's it. That's all right. You need to say.
Yeah, we talked
about
this a couple of
– as far as it needs to go.
His book was all about trying to – he came up with what he thought was a clever meme that everything the president's doing, everything that happens in this decade, it all came from the 80s. So he's like somehow comparing like healthcare reform to the Rubik's Cube. I don't know exactly how, but that's
exactly what he did. And Sirota is every time. Really, Oliver Willis calling him serially stupid is the funniest thing that has stuck with me. That's the meme that stuck with me when it comes to him. Whenever I mention his name, I make sure and put that in front of it.
Well, as a casual reader, you know, the guy writes for Salon. I mean, there's going to be – and Joan Walsh writes for Salon as well. Glenn Greenwald writes for Salon. That gives them some gravitas. They actually are given a certain amount of weight and a certain amount of consideration because they write for a well-reputed website. You know, so I think in that respect, you know, it's not like they're off – you're shouting at the raindrops off in their own blog. And, you know, you can kind of take it with a grain of salt because, well, who the hell are they? Well, they're people who have a reputation and who write for a reputed blog or a website. And so, you know, maybe we should take them seriously. I don't know. They're saying President Obama's failing left and right. Oh, my God. Maybe
I'm not sure
is.
How much they influence. As a matter of fact, I know. I guarantee you they don't influence a vast swath of independent voters in this country. I guarantee you most voters, most people have no freaking clue. Even, you know, people on the left will, I'm sure, especially on the far left. And even some people on the far right will, because, of course, they'll know to hate them. But I guarantee you there are a ton of people in the middle that have no freaking clue who any of these people we're talking about are. The difference is how much they can get a meme going and they can sort of get the snowball rolling so that it then begins to sort of boil over into, as I mix my metaphors, into the mainstream media, so that people out there who maybe don't pay that much attention to politics do know who these people are because they're starting to sort of feel the effects of their opinions.
Well, I mean, it doesn't, and it ultimately, though, it doesn't matter who they are, because once the meme is out there, it's you know, the name that started the meme is irrelevant.
That's
so
true.
As you started by saying that, you know, the president didn't do enough for gay people. You know, suddenly that, you know, we say that to one person and they say it to the next person and it becomes a water cooler thing. Then everyone's saying it and it has no basis in reality whatsoever.
No.
I mean, you know, John Aravosa.
And that's one of the reasons why I feel like one of the worst people on earth, because I think Dan Choi did quite a bit for gay rights, of course. But I think he's an asshole. I think he's a raging asshole. And every time he opens his mouth and I see him on TV, it's like I should look at him and think, man, good for you. You fought really hard. You stuck by your convictions, stood by, you know, the courage of being who you are. And yet the constant beating up of Obama, that because you weren't getting exactly what you wanted when you wanted it, that made – plus, of course, the fact that Hampshire got behind him and you know, made him her personal puppet. That just – I mean, that bugged the crap out of me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, here's what John Aravosa had to write about. Well, John Aravosa kind of did a compare and contrast between Clinton and Obama on gay rights, on LGBT issues.
Right.
So he's basically just scoffing off. He's saying, yeah, you know what? He did some bad things, but oh, well, what are you going to do? And then he says President Obama gets big kudos for his repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, as if he shouldn't. You know, the implication is, well, yeah, big kudos for Don't Ask, Don't Tell. What is Don't Ask, Don't Tell anyway? Who cares? But other than that, he says, but other than that, I'm hard-pressed to come up with as many examples of President Obama using his limited
support. Other than that. That should be good enough. It really should. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm not saying that you know, there isn't more that can be done or should be done, but I'm saying that in the great scheme of things, that's a pretty massive, that's an evolutionary leap there.
But other than that, I'm hard-pressed to come up with as many examples of President Obama using his limited supply of political chits for the gay community.
Everybody wants their shit now. They are. Everybody's a baby.
But you see,
and I mean that across the board. I mean right, left. It's not even just right and left anymore. It's all these little groups. And because of the way the media is structured now, the fragmented nature of it, everybody has their sort of bullhorn. And nobody's happy. Nobody's happy because their pet project is not the number one priority of the president of the fucking United States.
But this is
a president, by the way, who has more on his plate probably than any president in the last 60 years.
But the irrationality of that, the fact that he did do all of these things. I mean, he did make it, you know, he did allow federal government workers who happen to be gay to give their benefits, also to share their benefits with their same sex partner. That's what President Obama did. President Obama appointed more LGBT people to his cabinet and to his administration than any other president combined. That's a fact. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, as you said, that's the biggest thing. That should be enough. You know, but then there are all these other things. So if you're actually saying, if you're trying to convince me that he hasn't done anything, in light of the actual facts of what he has done in reality, in our known universe, there's got to be some other. What is creating this level of intellectual dishonesty? Where is this coming from? What is feeding this level of irrationality with regards to what we see? You can actually take out a piece of loose leaf paper and write a list. There's a website called What the Fuck Has Obama Done? Where you can actually go and look and you can see all of the different things that he has done. These are empirical facts. And to say that, it's just don't ask, don't tell. But other than that, what did he do? I don't know. Nothing. He clearly hates gay people. I mean, that's kind of the implication. And just this level of dissatisfaction. I understand that in the process of holding someone accountable, you've got to say, well, you're not doing enough and you need to do more. Well, you can say that, but when it sort of grows and snowballs into this most annoying sound in the world, all that's happening is shouting and rage, it just becomes this loud white noise of nonsense, and people don't pay attention to that anymore. What you want to do, make a valid policy argument to say, more can be done and here's how. I'm going to type up a memo. You do it like Steve Bannon. When Steve Bannon has an issue with the Obama administration, says they're at an impasse. They don't know what to do about, I don't know, healthcare. You know what he does? He fires off a memo and sends it to the White House, a formal policy-driven memo. It says, here's how you can get this passed. Here's the strategy. Here's the policy. Here you go. And they read it. And they look at it and say, you know what? This is a good idea. But you stand there and you scream that... Don't ask, don't tell repeal, like that's anything. You know, this is all it does is get you ignored.
They're children. I mean, they really, really are. It's like there are things that you have every single right to be pissed about. I get it. You know, there are things that Obama has and hasn't done that upset me. But make some constructive criticism. Push in the right direction. But, you know, I mean, I think we're... The way that certainly where guys like Greenwald and Hampshire and Sirota sort of the way that they kind of inoculate themselves to doing that, to offering constructive criticism is Greenwald's done it a ton of times, is they say he's not even approaching it from a progressive standpoint. So any sort of, look, I know you mean well, but here's what we should be doing to fight harder. They don't do that. They just have this attitude that, you know what, Obama doesn't care about you, doesn't care about liberals, doesn't care about progressives at all, doesn't want any of the same things we want. And I mean, as I said, Greenwald will pen these very long pieces trying to prove the point that Obama just doesn't, he's not progressive. That simple. He's not. So trying to demand smart accountability from him is a waste. You have to essentially label him an enemy combatant, you know, or a hostile witness. You have to put him on the other side, and that's what they do. Yeah. He's not giving us everything we want. Therefore, he is obviously not liberal because, well, I'm liberal, and if you're not giving me what I want, then that means you're not.
Yeah. So, I mean,
it's ridiculous.
Right. And going back to your metaphor earlier, what's the frog DNA? What's the disconnect? Why is there such a lack of rationality and so much intellectual dishonesty coming from the left? What is motivating it? Could it be racism? Possibly. Melissa Harris-Perry makes a great argument for that. Could it be careerism? I believe that that's the main thing that's happening. People tapping into a demographic, yeah.
I wonder sometimes if also, you know, one of the – this was a little a little meme that was going on a couple of weeks ago. I read a couple of pieces about this that basically said that one of the ways that the Tea Party was going to attempt to get Obama out and get anybody in besides Obama is they were going to basically more hostage politics. They were going to essentially kind of put the word out, and they're already doing it, put the word out that, look, all this insanity that's going on in the country right now, all this craziness that we are creating, all this absolute bullshit you're seeing, this the country just going up in flames with insane anger and obstruction, and everything is about to shut down and all that. That will all go away if Obama goes away. That's all you got to do. All you got to do is just toss him out. Wash your hands of him. Toss him out in the street. We'll take care of the rest.
And well, you got to wonder about the motivation.
What I mean by that, though, before you say anything, is I'm wondering if maybe there are people who are just tired of the insanity. Even people on the left who they want to fight, but they're just tired of sort of the absolute chaos that has come with this president. And in some way, you know, if you can make the argument that if you can jump to the conclusion. And once again, I think Melissa Harris Perry presented some great points. But if you can automatically jump to the conclusion that there's racism, then you can very easily jump to the conclusion that maybe people are just tired of the Obama presidency in the sense of all of the other extraneous shit that it's brought with it.
Yeah. But you got to question the motivations of people who deliberately try to rig the game so that an opposition leader can ascend to the White House so they can continue to bitch. You know, so they can have another George W. Bush to kick around and boost their ratings. And I believe that that is happening. I believe that that is happening on the left. Where
Fox has done gangbusters since Obama got in. I mean, you know, you thought they were doing well when Bush was in the White House? Holy hell.
I mean, if you're just a regular voter and you read this stuff and, you know, you're kind of only tangentially associated with it, And you're frustrated with all of the shouting and the hoo-ha going on, and you want to break away from it, that's fine. You know, just turn on something else, you know. Think about, you know, maybe coming back to it in a month or two. Take a break, take a breather. That's fine. But when you're actually – you hold a position of responsibility and you've risen the ranks of the lefty blogosphere and you're up there and people are reading you and you've got a following – you know, don't it screams of a rigged game. Like, we're going to create a self-fulfilling prophecy here, and we're going to create all of this disillusionment so, you know, Wingnut X is elected next year and we can have something to really seriously bitch about again.
The other thing is that especially in a depressed economy, I mean, this heightens it. Liberals are natural contrarians. They are. They're not all, but the cliche is that they're against the system. And, you know, let's face it. I mean, everybody I know who's liberal is somewhat cynical, usually overly analytical. But yeah, they're usually very contrarian. And now you got a guy in office and it's almost like the natural thing to do is to beat him up. There's no sort of sense of real loyalty there. There really isn't. You know, when Republicans get somebody in office, holy crap, they'll put bumper stickers all over their house and they'll move heaven and earth to keep that guy there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's face it. I mean, liberals were not lockstep. I mean, Democrats, not lockstep. I mean, there's
no.
But, you know, at least if we're disagreeing, can we try to at least disagree based on the policy and not come up with, you know, make a valid argument for why, you know, look at actual, you know, I'm actually getting exhausted with it. I mean, because it's so, again, it's like dealing with Tea Party people. When you're talking about, when David Sirota says that that Barack Obama is engaging in military adventurism by supporting a NATO operation in Libya. There's no reality there. How do you make a counter argument? How do you say, well, you know, how do you pinpoint the reality of what David Sirota is saying in order to refute it, other than to just say, well, it's but you're just tripping over your tongue in order to get to, you know, what's easily the most ridiculous thing, one of the most ridiculous things that Sirota has ever said. It's a military adventurism.
I got into a back and forth with on Twitter with Greenwald at one point, and it was because he had said something. I can't remember what it was. He had said something about I don't want to say it was CIA prisons or something like that. I really can't remember. I said, thank God you're there to bring out this injustice. And it wasn't CIA prison. It was something much less nefarious. You know, and he wrote me back, and his big thing was, I'll bet you didn't say that during the Bush administration. That seems to be one of the big talking points for them, is all the things that happened during Bush, we let Obama get away with. And to some extent, look, you know what? There are things that Obama does that Bush did that I think are wrong, and I think it's wrong now, and I'm more than happy to point that out. But I think that's funny because they assume that everything – that there's some sort of hypocrisy coming from, like, Greenwald assumed that there was some sort of hypocrisy coming from me about that. And he just said, he's like, I'll bet if I went back through your blog, I could find all these times that you beat up on it when Bush did it. And now you don't say anything and you defend it when Obama doesn't. And I just basically said, I'm like, if you want to take the time and waste your time, go right ahead. Like, go through the blog. Feel free. Seriously. Because I guarantee you, you'll find nothing. I never wrote about it. In other words, I wasn't pissed about it when it was happening during the Bush years, and I'm not pissed about it now.
Yeah. Well, there's a different – it's all about context. I mean, if President Obama does something that seems Bushish, and he, you know, there's some foreign policy things that are, you know, disappointments. Let's face it.
Yeah, but the reason I brought that up is because I think there's such a – you know, we used to use the term, you know, Bush's adventure in Iraq, which even that was stupid. It sounds like a freaking theme park. But, you know, I mean, and now Sirota's using the term adventure in Libya as if they're sort of one and the same, as if what happened in Libya is comparable to, and what Obama did in Libya is comparable to what Bush did in Iraq. And they are opposite ends of the spectrum. To even sort of try to put them in the same, you know, I mean, admittedly, yes, there, of course, some similarities are there. But to put them in the same category is intellectually dishonest, bordering on fucking ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, there's so many different things that you could actually draw distinctions between those two actions, which, again, you got to question, well, why is David Sirota engaging in such nonsense? What's motivating him to do that? You know, because clearly the facts are not on his side. He's created some meme. It's false. It's wrong. It's highly inaccurate. But why is he blurting that out? What's his motivation?
He wrote a book blaming, you know, the political. I go back to it again. Blaming today's political, you know, system for he blamed it on Ghostbusters. I mean, if that's not somebody who likes attention, come on.
Right. This show brought to you by Bubble Genius, as always, bubblegenius.com. It's the best goddamn soap in the world. Pure products, pure genius, Bubble Genius. And here is their latest commercial.
Well, it looks like summer skedaddled and that wicked winter air is setting in.
And you know how washing up in winter can leave your hands drier than Rick Perry's hooses on a Saturday night.
Well, friend, fret no more. Whip your dry skin into shape
with whoop-ass hand balm from Bubble Genius.
Them good folks over at Bubble Genius have loaded up their whoop-ass with a whole mess of nature's goodies.
Like genuine shea butter and sweet almond oil.
Citrus extracts and sage.
Which are wonderful for healing and fixing your skin right up.
This here ain't no sissy hand balm. This here's some serious stuff.
So if long days out on the range are leaving your skin tighter than socks on a rooster,
then it sure is time to open a can of whoop-ass.
By the by, this stuff's great on rough elbows.
And knees, too. Hear that, Mitch McConnell?
Check out the entire line of whoop-ass products, including body whip and soap, at bubblegenius.com.
Bubble Genius. Y'all suds up now, you hear?
Shove Bob and Chez into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go.
Pants.
Subscribe to the Bob and Chez Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
And that promo code, one last time, for 15% off your entire Bubble Genius order is Bob and Chez. Type in BOBANDCHEZ and get a big-time discount when you buy soap from Bubble Genius. So I think, you know, there's not a whole lot else we can say on this topic. In fact, we did spend almost an entire show several weeks ago talking about the problems in the progressive movement. And it was this guy, this blogger, Extreme Liberal, went ahead and transcribed the entire conversation.
Yeah, I saw that. That was very cool and insane at the same time.
Yeah. So, I mean, we just recently talked about all this stuff, but it's important to bring it up and reinforce whenever necessary. And I think, yeah, I think it's one thing that liberals don't do enough. We can't be afraid to be a little repetitive. Get some message out there. You got to keep repeating it. You got to kind of beat it to death. It's almost like television. Beat it to death if it succeeds.
I'm all about beating my television to death.
So, but I mean, if you want to read more about it, it's posted on the blog, and you'll see it all over Twitter. I mean, everyone's talking about it on Twitter right now. And, you know, the reason I kind of, the way I was introduced to the topic was that, you know, I was on Twitter a couple of days ago, and I see this tweet by Sirota come down, and it says, you know, in all caps, he says, "incredibly telling," colon, and then something to the effect of, "my assistant says that Melissa Harris Perry is declining to be on my show."
No, she just thinks that you're a tool and you're not all that fucking important, Sirota.
Right.
She doesn't have to come calling. And just because she doesn't want to talk to you doesn't mean that she's avoiding you because she's afraid you're going to hang her out to dry or because you know something she doesn't. It's because you're not important.
Yeah. And that, you know, she's got things to do. I mean, she's got a full plate of things, which is what she responded. She responded on Twitter by saying, "look, I got a bunch of shit this week. My schedule is packed full. My assistant is not clearing me for any additional things because I've got all my calendar is full of things already. I don't have time for your things because I'm doing other things."
But Sirota's comment is perfect. It's me, 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 me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
why is this person not paying attention to me?
Right. And the assumption is that that everything is a conspiracy against him. Everything is a conspiracy against progressives.
It's the conspiracy thing. It's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone wants to beat up on hippies. And so now they're being, look at Melissa Harris Perry, who's clearly an Obama apologist, an Obot. And now she's beating up on me. She doesn't want to be on my show.
You know. I'm going to go sit in the corner and cry.
Yeah. And look
bitch
at
about
this.
How, you know, bitch about why vegan products are made to taste like meat. I just don't understand that. So can't you just be a vegan and be miserable?
So, I mean, here's Sirota, here's, you know, Aravosis, all the usual suspects. You know, you get a strong voice, a strong, articulate voice on the left, Melissa Harris Perry, who's rapidly breaking into television as well. I think she'd be fantastic hosting a show on MSNBC.
I think so, too. I like her a lot.
And, I mean, she's a natural. She goes on TV, knows how to talk, knows how to speak intelligently, extemporaneously on a variety of things, and she knows how to make sense, and she's very smart. It's like Rachel Maddow, you know? And what do we do?
Did you just call the black woman articulate? Because that's racist.
Did I say articulate?
I'm just joking. I'm inferring articulate. I'm just being a dick.
I was like, oh, shit. Did I say articulate?
She speaks so
well. I can't believe I did that. But, you know, but here we are. You know, let's tear her down because we can't have that. You know, we can't have, you know, a liberal who's actually becoming popular on television. You got to rip her to shreds. And so that's what they do. The only thing, the only reason she's popular is, you know, she's in cahoots with the president. She's part of the conspiracy.
That's right.
To do what? I have no idea. But it's, you know, it's so easy to draw parallels between, you know, either whether it's Wayne LaPierre saying he's, oh, the president's banning or is pro-gun because he's anti-gun.
Right.
He's so pro-gun that he's actually gone around the other side of the circle.
Right. I use that saying a lot, that after a while you just go so far around that you come out on the other side.
So I tweeted a couple things at Sirota, which he didn't respond to. I'm not surprised.
Sirota's responded to one or two things that I put up. The Twitter fight thing, this is totally off subject, but it's just the Twitter fight thing, there's nothing in the world more ridiculous.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, it is.
The stupid fucking 140 character back and forth with people you don't know who, you know, you're approaching an argument from different sides, and it's just nothing will be solved in that. It's just there's nothing dumber, there's nothing more childish than fighting with somebody on Twitter.
So here's what I want to do at the end of the show, because we did talk about a lot about the discussion regarding the president's record. And I did want to enter into the show, to the recording of the show here, some actual bits and pieces of the president's record. Now, if you want to see this, there's a great website. It's called whatthefuckhasobamadonesofar.com. That's the domain name. WhatTheFuckHasObamaDoneSoFar.com. I'm just going to go page through a few of these things. And you decide for yourself. Don't take it from me. Don't take it from Chez. Decide for yourself whether or not this is a solid record and whether or not this is liberal enough for you. Okay? Here's the first thing. I just opened the site. The first thing to pop up, significantly increased funding for the Violence Against Women Act. Here's the next thing. Lifted restrictions granting Cuban Americans unrestricted right to visit family and send remittances to the island. Eliminated subsidies to private lender middlemen of student loans and protect student bar. Big time student loan reform. Increased funding for national parks and forests by 10%. Significantly expanded Pell Grants, which help low-income students pay for college. Expanded hate crime law in the U.S. to include sexual orientation through the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. Not quickly enough. He didn't do it on day one, so fail.
Hey, he didn't do it fast enough to save Matthew Shepard and James Byrd. Sorry.
I'm trying not to laugh.
I suck.
Jesus Christ.
If he had been a true liberal, he would have saved them. James Byrd wouldn't be dead in pieces, and Matthew Shepard wouldn't be tacked to a fucking fence in Wyoming.
Oh my God.
He's not a progressive. He's not one of us.
Provided stimulus funding to boost private sector spaceflight programs.
I love when I can break you up. Thank God.
Appointed nation's first chief technology officer. Signed financial reform law establishing a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to look out for the interests of everyday Americans. Signed financial reform law requiring lenders to verify applicants' credit history, income, employment status. Let's see what else here. Signed financial reform law prohibiting banks from engaging in proprietary trading. See, it's running a little slow here. Oh, no, it's giving me the same one over and over again. Cut prescription drug costs for Medicare recipients by 50%. Right? Provided $12.2 billion in new funding for Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Extended benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees. Not good enough. Appointed more openly gay officials than any other president in U.S. history. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, a $789 billion economic stimulus plan.
Not enough.
Well, you know what? I actually believe that it's not big enough. But you know what? You know what? I know why it's not big enough.
Right.
Because there are people in Congress, people in the United States Senate, for example, who will not vote for something any bigger, who refuse to vote for anything bigger. And because of the way democracy is set up, the way the legislative process is set up in the United States Congress, you need a certain number of votes in order to pass something. And in order to pass something, you need to get certain people to sign on to it and pledge their vote for it. And without those people, it doesn't get done. So would you rather have $789 billion economic stimulus plan or a $0 economic stimulus plan?
Well, I'm not going to go off on this tangent, but that's what it comes down to. This is that comment that Angry Black Lady reposted a week ago, I guess. The one from the guy who said, what was it? 0-8-10. Are you happy with, eight out of the 10 things that you want, or zero out of the 10 things that you want? Or do you have to be a whiny fucking baby, and if you don't get 10 out of the 10 things you want, you complain up a storm? You throw a temper tantrum.
Created more private sector jobs in 2010 than during the entire Bush years. Voluntary disclosure of White House visitors for the first time in U.S. history. appointed first Latina to the U.S. Supreme Court. Promoted social responsibility through creation of serve.gov, a national database of volunteer opportunities. Reversed global gag rule, allowing USAID to go to organizations regardless of whether they provide abortions, just like Bush. Signed the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, giving the FDA the authority to regulate the manufacturing, marketing, and sale of tobacco for the first time. I didn't even know about that one. Signed new START treaty, nuclear arms reduction pact with Russia. Increased average fuel economy standards from 27.5 miles per gallon to 35.5 miles per gallon starting in 2016. Signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Play Act, restoring basic protections against pay discrimination for women and other workers, just like Bush. Provided travel expenses to families of fallen soldiers to be on hand when the bodies arrive at Dover Air Force Base. Reversed the policy of barring media coverage during the return of fallen soldiers to Dover Air Force Base. Launched recovery.gov to track spending from the Recovery Act, providing transparency and allowing the public to report fraud, waste, or abuse. Provided Department of Veterans Affairs with more than $1.4 billion to improve services to American veterans because, you know, he hates the troops. Signed the Children's Health Insurance Reauthorization Act, which provides health care to 11 million kids, 4 million of whom were previously uninsured. Here's, I'm going to do one last one. Issued executive order to repeal Bush-era restrictions on federal funding for embryonic stem cell research.
There you go.
Oh, God.
And you forgot, gave a Navy SEAL an order to put a bullet in Osama bin Laden's eye.
That's right.
There's always that.
That's a pretty big one. Ended the war in Iraq. Yep. That's a big one, too. Ended it. It's done. Yep. No more Iraq war. But he's engaged in military adventurism in Libya, you know, by providing air support to a NATO operation.
Fuck you, Sirota.
God, like that's any that's anywhere remotely similar to the invasion of Iraq, the unilateral illegal invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
There's nothing similar. And if you think there's something similar, you're being intellectually dishonest. And why are you doing that? I want to know. Melissa Harris Perry wants to know. We all want to know what's motivating you to do that, David Sirota, John Aravosis, Jane Hampshire, Glenn Greenwald. What's the point? It's accountability. Learn how to hold people accountable. There's a smart way to do it, and there's a stupid way to do it. You're doing it the stupid way.
You're doing it wrong.
Read the president's books. Decide for yourself if there's anything in this man's history that shows to you that he responds to yelling, that he responds to ongoing shouting and anger, blind rage. He doesn't. He doesn't respond to that. So make a policy argument in favor of your position. Beat it to death.
It's funny, I don't even think it's yelling, because I can't imagine Greenwald or Sirota yelling at their keyboard. I think it's just, it's sanctimonious pissiness.
Well, that's just it. I say it's yelling and shouting.
Yeah.
But it's you know, it's like Greenwald going on and calling anyone who supports the president as Obama lovers. Yeah, that's ridiculous, blind rage.
It's nose in the air. It's nose in the air, condescending bullshit.
Yeah, it accomplishes nothing. Nothing. To say that the president hasn't done enough for LGBT is wrong. I mean, it's just absolutely wrong. You think you should do more?
I think you should add one more letter on there. Just pick one. Doesn't even matter.
Z.
LGBTZ. We'll come up with what the Z stands for later. Don't worry about it.
If you want him to do...
See, now you have one more letter.
If you want him to do more, outline what those things are. And push those things. It's that simple. It's just those things. Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Drive safely, and we'll see you next week, Chess.
See ya.